Om Agyana Chativandasya.
Om Agyana Chativandasya.
Gyananjana Salakaya.
Gyananjana Salakaya.
Chakshurunitam Yena.
Chakshurunitam Yena.
Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha.
Tasmai Shri Gurave
Namaha. So we are trying to continue what we started last night. And my name is. I lose my story. Hanumat Prashak Swami. Swami's not a bishop. And so I was born on Guam, in the Marianas Islands, and I left there when I was this big or something. Grew up in Southwest Arizona, California, and I graduated in psychology. Minor studies in biology and electrical engineering, first place. And eventually, you know, I had a black belt in Okinawa, karate, studied improvisational theater. And eventually I came in contact with A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami and Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. And so what we're doing here is very, very traditional. It's part of the very, very long tradition of mysticism and everything else. And why doesn't everybody take to it? It's so valuable. Well, why does everybody have diamonds and pearls on the site? It's difficult. You have a certain kind of cultural assets. So we're trying to relate this culture because in many ways it's very different. They're very different. We've been working a long time even with Nobel laureates and professors. One time we took quite a few professors from Seattle and other areas that we had met on some of these cultural tours to Calcutta. India. And they arrived. They arrived a little bit late at night. We took them right to the hotel and the airport and stuff and got up in the morning. And they were going to go to Navadweep, which is a very esoteric remote place. We didn't get there. And before they wanted to go shopping. So we would take them to New Market in Calcutta. New Market, underground market, unbelievable place. Has no beginning, no middle, no end. So anyway, so we got in three cars and different people, and I was looking out the window, and I've been to India since the first time I went was 1978, maybe 25, 30 times now. And so many ways I understand the culture, being sort of, but then I was looking at these things and wondering, what are these people going to think? We're going through Calcutta and there's like this dirty water coming out of the sewer. There's a 12-year-old girl bathing her 11-year-old brother and 8-year-old sister with dirty water and all this stuff. It's like, but that's not dirty water. It's water from the Ganges. The British put in an entire irrigation system. And that water is so potent that you put anything in, even dead corpse in it, it'll purify it. It's a big mystery why and how the Ganges works and stuff. So when I got there, I was asking them, these are big professors of travel in Europe and Japan. What did you think of this? And one guy told me, he said, I was trying to adjust it in terms of like, you know, what I'd seen in Europe and things like that. Oh, this is like that. But my final conclusion was, this is totally a new environment. We're all breathing.
Okay.
Yeah. So building these bridges between East and West, between different cultures, has always been a big job. So trying to do this, one of the best resources we found again was Carl Jung. And we mentioned last night that Prabhupada, looking at Western philosophers and going through them, said that of all the Western philosophers, Carl Jung had the most sense. And we also mentioned the Tavistock lectures. It was after World War I, before World War II. Jung again was about 30 years old, I think, when Prabhupada was born. And he gave us some history last night. How many people were here last night? We're discussing Jung's whole history and the whole development of psychology, because when he was growing up, psychology was totally like this madness, you're possessed and beat the guy until he dies or something, or, you know, very difficult environment. But then about his time when he was becoming an adult and starting to enter into his medical career, some people were saying, let's try and cure these things. And, you know, it's a history of the mind, it's trying to deal with it. So you know, he was in that environment. So after World War I, before World War II, he gave these lectures at the Tavistock Foundation, which is still there in London, still organizes very interesting potent conferences. And many of that doctors and scientists there. At one point, he was becoming a little bit frustrated. And he said, you modern scientific people think that these ancient Indian Chinese and Indian and Chinese sages were fools. You know, they aren't the fools. We are the fools. You know? In terms of introspective psychology, Europe is just a peninsula of Asia and China. These people have a knowledge which is just unbelievable, profound in terms of this. Even I was looking at an encyclopedia of world music, and it came to India, and he said, Indian music tradition has developed a rhythm and melody, harmony, to an extent unimagined by Western musicians. So one thing, when you start to investigate traditional cultures, Indian, Chinese, you discover in certain areas, you know, we are the third world country. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much advance, and so we have to take them. So that's the thing, there was this very, very powerful colonial arrogance. Colonial ideas fell all over the world. We know everything. And it stifles so many good things in the world. People make this comment that, for example, South America, India, they got political independence at some point, but neither one of them have really achieved, what's the word, achieved cultural independence. It's not quite transparent yet. They can adjust. I understand. Yeah, they can adjust. They can adjust a little. Okay, you got it. Not back there. It's okay. It's good. Good. Go ahead. Yeah. I was just telling them how to adjust. Okay. So anyway, it's a big topic, very big area, and we're working on this. It's been a very, very good tool because the lecture series we've developed pretty much is science, psyche, and spirituality. Science, psyche, and spirituality. The encounter of Carl Gustav Jung with the ancient mysticism of India. And it's very good. It's an attractive title. It's honest. At one time, for example, we're doing a program in Santiago at the, what's it called? It was a guy named Pablo Neruda Foundation. They have two Nobel laureates in literature come out of it. Their poetry is actually good. Gabriel Mistral and Pablo Neruda. So Pablo Neruda Center is, you know, it's a high-class cultural center, not too big. You know. So we're organizing the program. And we're waiting in the beginning, and then suddenly one guy walks in with maybe some followers, and everybody goes, and he was Umberto Maturana, and he's a candidate for Nobel Prize. His point was that Darwin was not a biologist. Darwin was an economist. Yeah. And he said, you look at things, even to the biological level, what the species of different species and things like that, those species that survive and prosper are not those that kill everybody else off, right? But those that learn to cooperate with others, even with their enemies. Cats are very territorial. How many noses do cats have? Have you learned something tonight?
Cats.
Cats. How many noses?
Just one cat has one nose.
Two. There's nostrils here. And like behind the teeth, they have another olfactory sensor like that. So the cat's really trying to smell something very carefully to see what was in his mouth. Somebody told me this, and I've been investigating for 50 years. It's always proved true. If you get within this distance of a cat's nose with your finger, he's forced to smell. Not too close, not too far. We get a little nervous, you put it there, it's an automatic reaction. Lion tamers. Any lion tamers here? They know. There's a certain distance with lions. You can bang your gun at them, crack the whip, and they'll hop around, do this and that, and okay, and so on. But a certain distance, if you get too close, these territorial instincts kick in. They cannot control themselves, even though they're being threatened, being shot, or anything else, and they'll kill you. So lion tamers know this. It's a certain distance, but they have this reaction. So anyway, different species, different reactions, different internal experiences. So his point is that, take cats. Cats are territorial. And the usual size of people's houses is not big enough for cat territory. So they end up fighting each other and growling and howling and fighting each other. So what they learn to do is that one cat will patrol a certain time, other cat will patrol another time. And they'll communicate, they'll leave messages by urinating places. Okay, what's going on? So this is his point, that evolution is not based upon survival of the fittest, it's based upon survival of those who are going to cooperate. So if that becomes our basic philosophy in life, it's going to make the world a whole lot different than what it is now. So he's a very big, prominent people. He's a guy that they know. And they like Carl Jung. They met Jung. And Jung is the highest, you know, culture they come in contact in terms of Western culture and philosophy. The prophet says it's true. So he was developing his ideas. And again, he had from previous life, he was basically on this level of what we would call Hiranyagarbha. One person is absorbed in his sense objects. Not even aware of his senses. Sometimes you drink enough, you get that same level. Maybe you have a experience. You're sitting there like, you know, rubbing your hand on something, watching the clock go around in the bar, like that, you know. Then sometimes you realize what you're doing is just a little nail sticking out of the bar and actually cutting your finger. That's your enjoyment. Or a camel enjoying chewing on bones. Okay, you can be at that level like a bacteria or something, absorb the sense objects. It's whack, whack. Come to your senses, man. Oh, God. Because now I'm aware of my senses, you know. But then still, whatever comes in front of me, good or bad. What's the next level? Sense objects, senses?
Mind.
The mind, yeah. And Descartes, very famous. He was looking into fire and not the fire, and not the eyes that watch the fire. And very, very famous Latin phrase, cogito ergo sum.
I think, therefore I am.
But Buddha says, yeah, come back behind. Yeah. But behind the manas, the mind, which is thinking, feeling, all these kind of things, is the intelligence, the perspective, the attitude. So we discussed this last night. And so Jung's, just by his birth, his karma, he was already, as a child, was already like experiencing that there's this, you know, so finally come to this point, Rudy, you can begin to appreciate the integrated nature of things. And your intelligence is connecting up and analyzing things and putting them like that. Perceptual levels, direct experience. So the drop group, you know, the hands and legs everywhere, you know, the priest, you know, the princess, these are all a part of the Rahu, the psychological things between bodies as we get. So above that, in Hiranyagarbha, which is like there's a sea behind it, not just a foreign, but there's kind of a seminal potency, which is allowing all of us to have. And funny, Paramatma. Paramatma is a soul, a person, hand of God and things. Then finally you realize who's connected to it, who's connected to the hand, like that, you know, what's behind the hand. But at a very high level, professional gamblers, they in touch with this, they know when to throw the money, when to, and so many people, doctors, psychologists, it's intuitive, introspective. And there are techniques, even in the West, there are techniques for developing introspective abilities, intuitive abilities, able to see whole gestalt at one time, all integrated at one time. It may take you 2 days to get it written down in some kind of linear form where you can read it and understand in a linear form. So Jung was kind of born like that. But there was no society, no association, no environments. He was struggling with these things himself. He went into medicine, and he was reading different things. Again, if you want to understand all of Western philosophy and stuff, you're satisfied from this psychological point of view. And then Jung is an acharya. He went through it all with such honesty, courage, like that and so on. The Mithra cults of Rome, you know, the alchemists and Marcellus and Magnus. And this is not where we are now. We think we've developed a very rational view. There are many big choices that were made, not by different people, you know, about how we're viewing the world. And it's not guaranteed this is the best way to do it. So as he was developing, he got in with the psychiatric movement and psychology. And they were developing techniques like free association, ink blocks and stuff to try and like get to people. They were having good results. People were getting into the subconscious mind, trying to map it. Then he met, Freud. And Freud was already on this level. And so they talked. When they first met, they were supposed to talk for maybe like half an hour. But Freud canceled all of his appointments. send them back to the madhouse. And for 6 hours straight, we were talking about their experiences. And Freud was maybe like about 20 years older than Jung or something. But Jung was also accepting synchronicities and supernatural phenomena. When he studied something like, something like 50% of all white males had some kind of psychotic breakdown. If we look at it, we wouldn't say psychotic breakdown, we'd say mystical experience. But for example, there was one lady, Alexandra Crisafulli, and she was a real estate agent in Berkeley, for us, for the temple and our houses. There's an association. Berkeley's a very liberal place, mental place. So I was coming back from the bank, I was a treasurer, and across the street, Telegraph Avenue, four lanes, and she cut across all four lanes in this park, the wrong direction, hopped out of her car, and ran towards me. I don't want to talk. Alexander, what's happening? Last night. Okay. So she had a girlfriend, who had gone to work with the Peace Corps in Central America, and she was very happy with it, and she came back, and she'd been renting like a little loft, room in a house, like an attic type place. And so Alexandria and her were putting everything away, so it would go into permanent storage. And then this the night before they had the last dinner together, and Alexandria was sitting with her, looking at this beautiful painting on the wall, and describing what a beautiful painting, how it's really caught, Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. And before her friend had been talking about like where she was, what it was like, and all these experiences. And then Alexandria looked at her friend was like, "What are you looking at?" Alexandra says, "What's wrong?" She said, "What do you see?" And she looked over, and it was a completely different thing. It was all these trees, these parrots, and this waterfall. That's what she was describing. She was describing the waterfall and all this kind of stuff. And she looked back, and it was the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco and stuff. And so she kind of fell off her chair and grabbed her. And her friend said, "What's even doubly confusing is because the scene you were describing is exactly the scene I see outside my window in Nicaragua." Exactly the scene I see there. So these things are common. But again, if she didn't have my association, she just would have forgot about it. When you wake up, you have a really interesting dream. Unless you write it down or something like that, within a few seconds, you won't be able to remember. If you want to, you just won't be able to remember. You've got to let go of it and catch it. So these experiences are like that. It's ephemeral. The association, everything else. So this is, Jung was experiencing this and trying to codify it and put it in some organized system and develop his own ideas. And so he was experiencing that certain thoughts appear in the attic. I think this, I think that. The Tavistock lectures, the general atmosphere was, we had World War I, it was a really terrible event, terrible experience. But it won't happen again, because we have so many different economic relationships, and all these agreements, and we're intelligent to do that again. He said, "No, that's all happening in the attic." He said, "The real motivation is in the heart. Indriya, senses, manas, thinking, buhi, the heart." And we're not even usually conscious of this. Sometimes we're conscious of our thoughts and we try to control them. But meditation is not what you think. From phrase, meditation is not what you think. It's being able to enter into this lower level. Change the attitude, the perspective of the basis on what you think. So he was coming to these different processes by nature and some association. So he was talking about these things that he said, in Germany, for example, there's this whole, it's starting to come again. He said, the blonde beast is waking up like that. He said, even when I go there, I just feel like these things about, Deutschland über alles and all these things. And, very archetypal images. You have like Wagner and Nietzsche. And they would all, thus spoke Zarathustra. This is one of the biggest classics in the West. Also sprach Zarathustra. Zarathustra is the archetypal figure from Zoroastrian culture. So Nietzsche and these guys had access to these things. They were looking at them in a worldview. Our worldview wasn't kind of supreme at that time. So he had this whole thing about thus spoke Zarathustra. And he has these things he says and so on. And I love him who sends golden words before his coming, who, when the dice fall in his favor, thinks, am I a cheater? Very nice fundamental things that really, you know, seem a higher life motivation and so on. And then finally, Zarathustra comes and sees all this modern world with like mechanism and organ, linear thinking and all this kind of stuff and planning, and how they've lost their heroic and epic, you know, views of the world. And so he's leaving and he gives his final thing, you know, his final statement to the people. And he says, there's a great cloud hanging over the modern world. And I am like the raindrops just falling on you now, like that. But the overman is coming. The Ubermensch. But the overman is coming, and the overman is the lightning. That's right. So Hitler came along looking at all this and said, wir sind die Ubermensch. We have come, and we are the Ubermensch. The Third Reich, the 1,000-year Reich. So it was motivated by very intense. What's the guy? Heckel. He was a German philosopher, biologist. He wrote a book called The Mysteries of the Universe. And Nobel laureates participated. He sold like 100,000 copies, which at that time was big. You know, and he was describing what his life and everything else. And one of his conclusions was we should have, genocide. Certain races and so on are a drag on our evolution, and we should exterminate them. So he was directly preaching genocide. But he was just a, you know, a philosopher. But then one German politician, Adolf Schippelruder, took it up and made it into actual political process. And during the process, he changed his name from Adolf Schippelruder to
Adolf Hitler.
And that was behind it. If you read the history of World War II, it's unbelievable how many people died and suffered. Unbelievable. You know? And all because of ideas. You know, ideas. It may not seem like much, but that's where it starts. It comes down to certain ideas that catch people. And usually it catches them through these iconographic things like that. You know? They have ideas, okay, intellectual, but when it comes to an archetype, an icon, and a movie and stuff, then it's just like, it catches people. So it was his comment. You're saying it's going to be no world war, but even when I'm there, I was just caught in his heroism and these things and everything else, his guiding images. So he say the same thing, chanting Hare Krishna, okay, you can chant, you can hear, but it has to come to smarana, meditation, contemplation. Without that, it's still superficial. And different levels of meditation, contemplation, it has to be there. In our literature, we're describing this, our process, our thing. This idea is to take advantage of this tremendous tradition. Our tradition has so much to offer people like that. Not the only one. It's very good, very practical. I'm talking about these people who are followers of Carl Jung and so on. Which again is not everybody. There are like a fair number of people who can appreciate these things. So, what is the community? I'm talking to people who are interested in this kind of thing. So I started investigating. Is there anybody who's still following Carl Jung? there's several magazines. Spring is the oldest. There's the one from London, the London Journal of Psychoanalytic Philosophy or something. About 3-4 big journals still publishing articles. And they're taking Jung's ideas and developing them, his techniques. He was doing a lot of art, like visual art. He'd have his patients drawing pictures and analyzing and looking at it, and you show how people can express themselves. How to get in touch with the subtler aspect and deal with that. But he said you can do anything. He also accepted dance and music. Some of his clients developed that. From our point of view, the hierarchy of the arts is the most subtlest music. After that comes dance, and then comes visual art, and so on. And so if you can deal with people on a level of acoustics and singing and stuff, you can get a much more potent, you know, potent communication with them and so on. Yeah. And you see, how much do people pay for a big concert? How much do tickets to a big concert cost? Well, yeah, because you can take your mind to someplace else. One time we were invited to our restaurant in Lima, maybe about like 3 times as big, and let's see, Miraflores, the restaurant thing. Well, yeah, big. So we were invited there. They said, well, how can we improve it? And he said, the first thing you have to do is to stop and listen. At lunchtime. And there's always like this kind of roar of noise going on. I was like, people banging pots. That's the first element in the situation. Sunday feast, okay? People take your prasadam. Always get the music going before you start distributing prasadam. And then it creates a certain ambience because the sound then comes touch, right? Tactile thing. Music will create a certain rhythm, it will create certain tonalities. It's heavy metal. I'm trying to eat prasadam. So you should pick out some heavy Bengali, some nice dinner music. So then first the sound, okay, so then they put doors on the kitchen. They hang up some tapestries on the wall, the conversation, become isolated, and then start playing the kind of music you want. And usually for a restaurant, for lunch music, you want a little bit like movement so people come and eat their lunch and get out.
Yeah.
Turn over. Yeah, because for dinner music, oh, it's longer, we're going to pay a lot more, they come and stay longer, okay. So see, music is the first thing, sound is the first element. Then after that, touch. Then after that, vision or fire. So we see based upon touch, texture. Every visual experience has a texture. Right? And every texture behind it has spatial orientation. It's a big area, it's a big, you know, this is basic Vedic philosophy of nature, science. From this you get architecture, music, what else, political science, everything else comes from the basic understanding of the elements and how they work, our medicine, everything. It's very practical when you get into it, it's very practical. It's not that Western science doesn't do anything, but it's based upon really the screwy kind of basis and the way they're doing stuff. So it's kind of, you know, limited. Yeah. And the broader perspective of why you're doing it, who benefits from modern science?
Pharmaceutical companies.
White, middle-aged males. They may have changed, but years ago they did a study, the communications, the medicine, all the technology, the things, white, middle-aged males, for the people who are really getting all the benefits out of it. Well, science is for everybody, you know what I'm saying? Somebody's paying money. Big Nobel laureates, that guy Francis Crick, not Francis Crick, no, his name now. Anyway, he was Nobel laureate. He said, all of my generation, we started doing science because it was high ideals. Science would tell us what is life, pain, suffering, who we are, and there'll be great adventures like that. We've always spoken of that. He said, but now, I'm shocked because I discovered basically 70% of all science is being funded by the military-industrial complex. How to kill other people, how to cause distress. He said, now scientists are giving some interesting problem and long-term funding. Do anything. There's no any longer any high perspective in it. But that's what makes the difference in science. That determines what kind of science you're going to do, everything else. So ultimately, it's not the mind, it's not the intelligence, it's the atma. With love, motivation, determination. Those are the real principles behind it. So, dealing with Jung and all these things, we organized in South America different programs. One of our strongest programs was with the, National Library. Step after step. Find it or not. So we did a program with the National Library. A big area. They have, very, very tremendous old books and everything else. Pretty powerful organization. So the first one was, first time we got in the basement. First we did it in a big cultural center, they liked us, and we got in the basement of the library. It's a nice basement. And then the director, people saw what kind of people were coming, and said, next year you're going to be up in the main auditorium. That was 3 years ago. So when we were in the basement, I was wondering, what kind of present? Because there's so many different things, and how to relate to these people, and how to present the idea. And then in the morning class, in the Bible talk, the couple was talking about the chakras and everything else. And then I realized this is exactly what Jung gave us here at Rutgers called Kundalini Yoga in Switzerland. And we have one other guy who was a Methodist who also been studying this in India. He had gone to India as a Methodist preacher to convert the Hindus to Christianity. He didn't get converted to Hinduism, but he had a lot of respect for it after he went there and investigated. So he was talking with Jung about the Kundalini yogas and the chakras and some shastras. And then Prabhupada's purport was talking about the same thing. Okay, so I just took Prabhupada's strategy and then applied it. Totally effective. You got to know people. You want to preach to people, you got to listen to them. You got to understand what is their language, what is their area, and be able to really, you know, communicate with them. So we're still investigating this whole thing. We discovered there are magazines available. There are still psychoanalysts. If you want to see a psychologist, you can see a Jungian psychologist. It may be very good. There's a whole history. One of the most central aspects of the whole Jungian culture now is the Philemon Foundation. Shoyu Shamdashan. He was Indian, obviously, from Singapore. And he was looking for God and everything else. And he wondered why psychology was in such a mess. Then he came in contact with Jung and said, yeah, this is, I dedicate my life to this. So now he's a professor of the history of medicine at the University of London. And he's a really good historian, really good person. I'm trying to get in touch with him and talk to him. So he's the person who's taking like untranslated works by Jung. I was mentioning how at this time letters were like full essays and stuff. So these things are just coming up, totally unedited, unpublished materials. And a lot of the stuff also wasn't even edited properly and so on. So there's a lot of original things that are coming out, like the Kundalini lectures. He did the historian's work. He found the letters that were kept before the thing and afterwards. He found the programs who was involved. There were two stenographers taking shorthand. He found Jung's notes on the thing, he found Miller's notes, then he reconstructed the thing. And so Jung is talking about the movement of Prabhupada too. And people in the West, they relate to this, okay? So Bhakti Yoga is kind of up there. First, there's the Prabhupada talks about it too. So there's the Muladhara Chakra, right? Muladhara Chakra. Yeah. It relates to three things: urinating, defecating, and copulating. You do any of these three things in public, you'll be arrested. Right? Yeah, you know. Some of you go to the stomach, solar plexus, heart, like that, like that, and so on. So, Jung was saying, you know, different people are on different levels of consciousness. And you can match it up very much with our analysis of anamaya, pranamaya, manomaya, like that. So you can match it up. It's the same thing, but we're just describing it in different ways. So, he was saying, like, different people, different communities are on different levels, different individuals, and maybe you're, you know, 80% in your Muladhara chakra and 2% in your mind. And you go around like, you know, a heavy construction worker, and you go home and slap your wife and have sex with her, you know, she bites you and sticks you with a knife, and you kick your kids, and you laugh with them. You know, it's like an animal. Okay, so guys, level of work and stuff. Where's that? So, you know, where are you? Like this or like that, or, you know, it's different levels of cathexis or energy, energizing tension in the chakras. So he's talking about that. He says, we Swiss people don't like to talk about anything below the diaphragm. But he said, Germans, they get right into it. Ah, it's good essen. good food. Ah. And he said, we Swiss people go, oh, good. So so different levels of consciousness. He's going up. You can match it to our culture and say, okay. And we have more details and so on many times like that. And sometimes you also, you're giving ideas and stuff which, you know, not mentioned in the Bible time, which are valid because he's experiencing it directly and so on. So you're going higher. And finally it comes up to the level of basically throw or something, which is space. And he says, this level is where spirituality begins. Well, it doesn't. It was about where he was, for him it was spiritual. He said, at this level, the only thing we can talk about maybe is fences. Sound creates space. So he was experiencing, he was actually talking about this and stuff. And it goes higher, and then we talk about the Brahmarandra, the Brahma Loka, and the whole body and so on. So this way, we try to match up the different people and attract them to our resources. At the same time, take advantage of what they have to contribute. Because again, Jung was describing these things from a self-realized point of view. He was saying somebody, they come to the level of monomania. Then everybody, how you comb your hair, and how you do things, and how you dress, and how you sit, it's all, that's it. That's the ultimate reality in society, and the king and the queen come in like this, and you follow like this and that. It's all mental platform, not even intellectual. But he said, it isn't all that important. But he said, you do it carefully dealing with people, because if you point out to them it's not all that important, some of them will go up. Some of them will fall then back down to bestial activity and so on. So sometimes yes, you're right. It's all very important. Keep on coming. Yeah. So very realized comments. And devotees who like this area. It's like, devotees who are cooking, read different cookbooks and stuff, and get ideas and stuff. And so on. How to cook, different instruments. The kitchen is, how technical is this kitchen? It's incredibly technical. So many machines, you can chop your hand right off there. So we take Mayantatami Dham Sarva, we take advantage of these things. And different people in different kinds of cultures. Myself, I'm attracted to some degree. Anyone else you mentioned here? So organizing this conference in Peru. Peru is a very nice place to organize. And every place has its advantages for preaching. In North America, it's very innovative. It's kind of new ideas, right? There are other cultures. Probably America is a place of most innovation. Other cultures are more traditional, classic, and so on. In other cultures, Germans are very mechanistic. Practically speaking, almost none of the books we have in America or even here you can sell in Germany. Because if it's a valuable book, that means it has to have a valuable binding. If the Bhagavad Gita is worth that much, then it should have like a $25 binding. So there's different cultures. One time, was a guy, Chakravarti, who came with Hansaduta to Berlin, and he was telling us like about Sankirtan preaching in Germany. They used to have assigned lines for everybody for your japa. This is your line. You go back and forth. I finished my round. Okay. So, he said one time he saw Maharam. He was like Hansaduta's, commander in chief of Sam book distribution. The Autobahn, the freeway is there, it's unlimited speed. So this guy would go right out in the middle of the Autobahn and stand in the freeway with his hand like this. His Mercedes would be slowing down from 200 kilometers per hour, braking. He would just stand there and brake, stopping right in front of him. And he'd walk around and say, I have something important to tell you. I can see. So one time he saw him preaching to this young German guy about the same age he was. The guy started arguing, he started pushing each other, he started hitting each other in the face. And then finally the guy bought the book. Yes, I can see you. Okay, thank you. Good. I'm convinced I'm glad to sign this. So Peru has been very, very effective because it is a country of the middle ground. Our big professor, Dimitri Katsikas, friend, is from Greece. And Greece is also a country of the middle ground. But in between the Orient and the Occident. But other people, totally than ourselves, make the same comment about Peru. If you go around Argentina, you'll find a pizzeria on every corner. So much Italian influence, they got big noses, like Roman Romans. But if you go to Peru, you find a chifa, Wong Pong chifa, Gofo chifa, and it's all these Chinese restaurants. The biggest chain of supermarkets is Iwong. Fujimora, one foreigner who was the president for a long time. So very, very much Oriental Chinese influence. And even you go back to the original culture with the Inca culture and so on also. They're using pulse for their indigenous medicine. So we bring Ayurvedic books there, it's just like, they relate to them right away and stuff. And maybe even produce something incredible. Because their pharmacology in the Amazon is unbelievable. More variety of insects of one tree in the Amazon than there is in all of Europe. These trees are big, 30 meters tall, so unbelievable. So another thing, of course, is the philosophy, the culture, the attitude. So it's right in between, because from there, what you do is you go right to Mexico or to the United States. Mexico is a suburb of Los Angeles. It's just so connected. From there, you can slide back into Peru. Peru's ideas develop. These subtle bodies are real, just as real as the gross bodies. Some species, they're covered by a false ego. They're covered by a certain body of perspectives, attitudes, which goes with that body. And they're covered by a certain body of mentality. Right? And they occupy a certain space, but they have no permanent tactile body, no permanent olfactory or so-and-so body. So you can, sometimes you look at ghosts, you say, well, somebody can say ghosts, yeah, this is ignorance. Bhutas, pretas, kushmandas, vinayakas, yakshas, rakshashas, gandharvas, kinaras, so many subtle things. It's kind of like trying to convince a cockroach about, you know, hey, there's horses, people, humans, cows, birds, they're all ghosts, you know. Yeah. So we, to the semi-demigods, the gandharvas and the fairies, we look like rats, you know. And to the real demigods, like Indra, we look like cockroaches. To Brahma, we look like atoms and molecules. You know? So the same way, different levels and species of life going on, real. So subtle bodies are real, they're actually factual. There are canaries, there are these people. And so many contact them with ghosts, right? You know? And of course, in our culture, we just eliminate them, make everything totally sterile and try and eliminate these things altogether, they don't exist. But people have these experiences, give them some opportunity, and they realize these things. We're not going to jump all the way to God in one step. The Bhagavatam also many times, you know, tries to go through different levels and appreciate that the sense of hearing is subtler than the sense of touch. You know, we did a whole program with architecture one time in Vastu. You know, a whole presentation for 4 days, graduate students, and the devotees had prasadam. And right in the middle of the prasadam, the director stopped everything and said, wait a second, what you're telling me is I'm not these eyes, I'm these ears. Right? It's a step up. Architect trying to do everything what it looks like. You know? No, you gotta feel it. Right? That's what makes a difference. And beyond that, acoustical perception, space being created by your thing. As the sunlight's going through your building, how does it change the space? How is it producing a song and stuff like that and so on? Now, every day the Eiffel Tower, he built the whole thing. It's an incredible the landmark of the development of science and engineering. You know, everything was prefabricated and fit exactly. He went there. But he forgot the fact that things made of iron. So when the sun comes up in the morning, what happens with iron?
One side will stretch.
He's out, so it pulls away, and by the other day it goes back. So you look at it, I forgot what it is, about this much space in the top or something. So every day the thing's going like this, you know, like that and so on. So there's so many subtle forces, you know, going on. And sound is the most subtle. You can enter into things through sound and stay in that level, acoustical level. Prabhupada says, I'm talking in the microphone, it's going around the world 6 times in a minute. So I investigated, it's the speed of light. Yeah. So we are producing gross sound like that. The kirtan can be at a totally external level. Or you can see how it's actually touching your prana, right? And actually touching something interior. The word spirit means prana, respiration, breathing, and so on. Holy Spirit. That's as high as they can appreciate it. Yeah? It's when you start to get some internal movement. Yeah? And it goes to different levels like that, and so on. So imagine these with the huge levels of taking people higher. So, so Peru. For example, there many people have these experiences, and this is part of the culture. But right in the middle of Lima, there's one building, it's like one block, and the bottom is like, you know, lunch counters for working people and cigar shops and all this kind of stuff you find in the downtown city. And on top is all gutted buildings, there's just nothing there but open windows. It's called a Casa Matusita. You know this? Conoce Casa Matusita? Va pasar una noche en Casa Matusita, you see? Famous haunted house. So one time we were doing a program and many Peruvian scientists there, and they took, you know, studied at MIT and, you know, Sorbonne, and coming back now to Peru. And a little bit skeptical about this description of Sankhya and different things. So I was a little frustrated. I said, well, how many of you would spend one night in Casa Matusita? They're all kind of smiling. You know, we may be scientists and everything else, but we're not fools. Maybe some gravity thing or something else like that there, but yeah, there's something there. And we're not going to consciously offend or shame them from the Andes or like that and stuff. But still, a lot of suspicion that maybe these things are true. And some people, yeah, they are true. You're dealing with different kinds of subtle beings. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, what is it? What's the name? So one reporter, when I first came here, he said, we modern scientific people don't believe in ghosts, everything else. We Peruvians have to get beyond this. I'm going to spend a whole night there, nothing will happen. So the sun came up, it didn't come out. Yeah. After a while, when it gets enough sunlight, some people went ahead and grabbed it. It was totally nuts. Completely like, took him to a mental hospital, lab for a few days, and kind of came back. You know, and I thought that was fun. You know Chiteshwar?
Chiteshwar.
From Orissa? Chiteshwar Das. He's our ISKCON Ghostbuster. he's a disciple of Jayantaka Maharaj. So he, his family are tantrics. You know? Their Ishtadevata is Panchamukha Hanuman. Hanuman with five faces, Nishinadeva, Ayurveda. Hanuman of his benediction, saving Ram, using the Shakti of all these avatars. This form will always be very ferocious and frightening, you know, to the demons. You know? So I met him talking about things. Okay, funny. He said, yeah, about, you know, almost half of what I'm doing is showmanship, just to, like, you know, it's better than television. I do this, and I report with this, and cut your nose and stuff. He said, the rest of it, you know, it's real. You know, things. One time he was exorcising. What's it? Jhanananda. You know Jhanananda? He was here. He was in somewhere in Australia. Jhanananda is a very sober guy, right? You know, a very literal guy. So one time Chiteshwar was here in Australia, and when Bhakta, who was like a crazy haunt or whatever, and they asked him, can you like exorcise this guy? And he said, well, yeah, we can do it and stuff, but who is his closest authority? Well, it's Bhakta leader, you know, like that. Why do you ask? Because when the ghost leaves, it's going to attack his closest authority. Well, don't worry, he's like in, you know, in Brisbane driving a van back from there. So it's not the physical distance, it's the psychological and emotional distance, like that. What kind of guy is this Jhanananda guy? Very hard minded, literal. Okay, we'll go ahead and drive. So Jhanananda told him, he was driving the van back, you know, a little bit of rain. At a certain point, about 12 o'clock, he noticed like, you know, certain kind of weird faces appearing in the back of trucks in the shadow. And he started feeling this cold sensation in his feet coming up. He started chanting, Hare Krishna, and went away. He would come again and start chanting, Hare Krishna. He thought, let it come up higher. It's not correct. So, let it come up higher, and he would chant. It lasted maybe about like 50 minutes to finally stop. And he got back, and that was exactly the time when Chiteshwar was exorcising this guy, and it worked. You know, that was like normal. Yeah. So, the subtle world exists. You know. So Jung was investigating these things, and his perspective was that, yeah, there is a subtle world, and it influences how we deal with it. It's not just the mind, it's also in the heart. Like he went to China, he went to India, and China, India, Africa, America, and so much investigation of all these cultures. I guess he came back from many, many very weird experiences with other people. So finally he came back, I think it was to Switzerland from India. Why he was in India, it was the University of Calcutta. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was there at the same time. He was talking to people about the culture and everything else. He got five honorary doctors. And then Mark Twain also went there. Mark Twain went around the world. His experiences in India are very interesting. He said, India is that place that once you've seen it, you won't trade it for all the circuses in the world. India is that place. It's so interesting. Full of variety, you won't trade your experiences for all the surfaces in the world. He said, in religion, India is the only millionaire. Right? India is the only millionaire. So people, big Western authorities and stuff. Yeah, appreciate it. So he came back and he had a heart attack, almost died. He had an out of body experience. He went way up above the earth, like that, and so on. And later on, he did talk to some astronomers and said, probably what happened then, probably about like, 15,000 feet or 25,000, more than that, 30,000 feet, more than that. Something, because you could see like the Europe there, it was kind of like in the middle, over the Middle East, Europe. I just said it was India. So, and he understood that, yeah, India is the solution, but I'm not ready for it, and the world's not ready for it yet. In the Kundalini lectures, he's talking about these things, how we have to develop our own understanding of these things. And we shouldn't take the Indian things. Why? So don't think it's because they don't know, and I'm minimizing them. is because trying to adopt these ideas now in the West, 1930 or something, would probably not only be useless, but maybe even dangerous. So Hitler took them, and now the most hated and feared symbol in the world is the symbol of good fortune. Yeah. And Aryans are considered like the most horrible culture in the world. So Jung was completely right.
Wow.
It wasn't the time to introduce it at that time. I think even he himself. So this out-of-body experience, so his recently in his body, he came down in India and there was this like stupa or something. More in Buddhism, it was more rational. He walked up the steps in this very beautiful marble place, and there was a yogi sitting there with all these little lamps in the place like that. And then the yogi kind of like this. There's a door. He approached that door, it was like an inner temple. He knew when he got there he would understand all these things about who he was on a subtle level and how he'd come back down into this world who was before, who his people were, and like, you know, his connection with them and so on. But then all of a sudden, his doctor stood in front of him in the dream and the experience. How do I call it a dream? And told him, Jung, you can't leave yet. Well, why not? Too many people in Europe want you, they need you. No, they can take care of themselves. No, you can't leave. So finally, the doctor stopped him. He came back. As he came back into his body, it was a terrible experience coming back into both of his body. This was like coming back into a box, you know, locked in this box. So many different experiences like that. Then his doctor was coming in and talking to him. He was weak. He told him, you've got to be careful, because I saw you active in your subtle body. So be very careful, because it's a very dangerous time for you. You could knock off the ghost thing. The doctor said, yeah, you will calm down. Take some more medicine. A few days later, the doctor died.
Ooh.
And he's like, I can go on. Unlimited experiences like this. And it's like, people who read the biography again, the biography is just like some intelligence, you realize, yeah, there's a lot of evidence for what these guys are talking about, the subtle world and so on. So, as we're going to meet in India, and then out of body experiences, different things, different Indians. One time, somebody asked him, he was talking about God, said, do you believe in God? Now, some people say, I believe in God, why? Because I go to church, I do the ritual, you know, I do the ritual, and I venerate the paraphernalia. And that's it, karma, the paraphernalia, the rituals, the activity, okay. And so, and I'm religious, I'm a Christian, I'm a Muslim, I'm whatever. But that's just very superficial. And beyond that, I understand what I'm doing. So, Kiana, you know. Some people have a good developed understanding of Christianity and things like that, intellectual. Then beyond that, beyond, what we actually learn is going beyond the mind into the iconographics, meditation, contemplation. Then we start to ask the same question, is there God? Because you're with him. You're experiencing his association, seeing his hand and things like that. So that was pretty much what Jung's development. And so he said, I don't know if there's a God or not. His not knowing is a big difference than somebody on a gross level. But it's something anybody who calls him a psychologist has to investigate. If you call yourself a psychologist, his point is you're not a psychologist, unless you're asking this question. He said, I don't know if it's a God or not, but I do know that if you don't believe in God, you'll go crazy. Right? It's a pragmatic thing. Yeah. So it's something crazy to you. Just eat yourself to death with, you know, potato chips and television and, you know, sex and all this kind of stuff. It's basically kill yourself. Some people walking around dead people. You know, they can do a simple job and go home and everything else is some sex. Some, basically, one guy told me, if you can control marijuana and beer, you can control this country. Because it's 90% of the people go home and they have to have a little bit of mild intoxication. They don't know how to dose themselves just properly. Buy some pizza, watch some new, you know, video. They go back to work. Yeah. They retire. They die when they're 5 years after retirement. That's it. That's their life. So you'll do that. Because the big question is too much unless God is there. So he was saying this is a pragmatic fact. You had to believe in God. But then the ways to deal with that and so on. So very, very high levels of questioning. Very effective area of preaching. Yeah. One time in Buenos Aires, one devotee was a psychologist. He said, arrange a lecture for you in my mental health center. Maybe like 600 people were, you know, clients there. And maybe like like 30 psychologists, social workers, women, men. And these are people who are dealing with, ladies, these are dealing with women who are on drugs, using prostitution to get money, who are lying to their family, lying to the psychologists, everything else. So you're used to dealing with people on this mental level like that and stuff, you know. So you come in and start talking about Krishna consciousness. Haribo, haribo, you know, that, you know, something. No, they're looking at you. This person really, you know, is lying to himself and lying to me. It's very challenging to deal with these people and be honest about how much you actually know and don't know. But afterwards, they bought like 4 to 5 books each person. You know, so 4 or 5 books each one. You know? So it's very, really different areas for preaching and stuff. And find your area, your way of doing it. Prabhupada told Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, every scientist 20 years ago, you make a devotee is worth 1,000 ordinary people. But the experience is it takes 1,000 times longer to make one science. So Prabhupada distributed books to 1,000 people and make them are all, you know. See, that's the same thing. Preach to the army and preach to the officers. You've got to have both. Right? And so a broad range preaching program, find your nature, your area, your people. His biography, he was there describing his experience. What we want to do, because Dr. Bhattacharya said that you can just tell me what department sponsored his lectures, then we go through and, you know, dig it out, we can probably find the transcripts of the lectures and everything else. And Shodhar Shamdashini, now this point of the year, he's turning on Africa first, trying to convince him, no, turn on India first, and do the research and all these things, and start recreating his experiences there. But for example, he was talking to these professors and stuff, we're hosting him about things. And he saw some sadhus, you know, some yogi guys sitting there, like I said, and he said, I'm not going to talk to them. You know? Because if I do, all I'm going to do is intellectualize everything they're giving me. You know? And I'll actually contaminate my ability to actually enter into their techniques and their meditation and stuff. And I'm ready for that. So yeah, he's very intelligent, but he realized there's a different level to this, and I'm not really ready for it yet, with the level they're doing it. His technique again was art. That's very good, visual art, we'll tell him. Higher than that is singing and dancing, what we do. Yeah. And he had a technique of introspective imagination, which was called something, it's called creative imagination, which other people have also developed when God in Egypt was doing it. You sit down and let your mind go. And many times you'll find that your mind actually goes a certain way. And it may go through the same thing again and again, you may have seen dreams again and again. You can start looking at both dream memes and so on. You can find them. They're very fundamental, you know, archetypes. These are part of our group. We have our archetypes, things that kick us off. It's something that always, if you do what you want to do, certain kind of girl, forget it. It's like, yeah, certain kind of guy, poof, you know, big mustache, okay. And certain things that just kick in and we don't even know why it is. It's just there are certain things that motivate us and we're vulnerable. If we're chanting from this level, dealing with these things, then we can protect ourselves. You know? If not, we're just, you know, whatever you smell, whatever a dog smells, forget it. It's gone. You know? It's gone. Same way, mind and finding the intelligence, then we can see that I'm really, you know, attracted by these things. You know? And again, icons. I was talking about the biggest American icon, James Bond. He's been going since I was in high school, when the second movie came out, whatever it was, From Russia With Love. This was the first one, was the very first one about Jamaica. There's so many actors about the world. James Bond has killed like something like 1,500 people or something. Or, you know, 15,000 people tried to kill him. Standing right in front of him with an AK-47 blasting away, they can't kill him. He's had sexual relations over 150 women. And so, you know, these are kind of qualifications of God, right? You know? And again, he's not an American, he's British. Canada and Australia have this heritage of British culture, or part of this culture. America had this genocide, what's it called? Patricide. They broke their culture and everything else, so they can't claim to be like, you know, you broke it. So therefore, they want something. So James Bond gives it to them. He's British. This kind of pseudo-British, you know, culture to him and stuff. So you analyze these things. Why is it there? You see, it's because we have this had its whole history. And Americans don't have that. They don't have a sense of, basically, the sense of what's for medieval history, what other cultures have it, and so on. Yeah. Okay, that's what they're going to act a certain way. Creative, innovative. America was formed, I'm pretty sure. Alexis de Tocqueville, a big French sociologist, he traveled around America after it was formed with a new constitution, political philosophy. And he said, this country is based upon ontological individualism, that the individual is the ultimate reality. Other places, not the society, whatever. He said, this will be the salvation and damnation of this country. In Germany, once you get to get the Third Reich going, everybody joins. That's what we do, is the society thing. In America, no, people, they'll think for themselves. But simultaneously, you try to get people to act as if they're American, they won't do it. One, Dr. Latsal, big manager in the medical industry, he decided to take charge of the temple in San Jose and organize the whole thing. After about 2 months, he told me, he said, it's totally different managing the nonprofit sector than the profit sector, and totally different than that, both managing the religious sector. He said, managing an ISKCON is like herding cats. Herding cats.
Yeah.
He said, devotees, but when you can motivate them, you can't pay people to do this. No way on earth people would do it for money. So it's a whole different motivational environment. So. And that's what you're trying to understand. You meet people. You can, what is it? You can, what is it, in Russia? You get off a bus in Russia, out in the country, you're stacking on a bus, get out, just like this, and everybody's like looking at you like guard dog and stuff, ready to jump on you and attack you. So right away, they pull out the accordion and start singing like in a Russian folk song and dancing, and everybody, oh, yes, babushka! Hare Krishna! Hare Krishna! What's your book? What's your philosophy? Put it in their language, scientific presentation, right? We're living in a scientific perspective. So, any questions or comments? If you want to get involved, we have our webpage, jayarama.us, and we're developing our public program, Neos Nimbus. We're developing this stuff. It's a whole, you can see, it's a whole area of developing. It's good results, and people come to the program, read the books, come to the temple, become big book distributors. We've done a lot of people coming out of this. But yeah, yes, sir.
Thank you, Maharaj.
I
think, if my memory serves me right, Carl Jung said that most of the problems in the world are spiritual problems, rooted in...
Yeah. But what does he mean by spirit?
Yeah, that's my question.
The word spirit again means prana. One time I was in Berkeley, I was walking around in the afternoon, chat my rounds, something like that. And we used to go by Peter Ralston's Kung Fu studio, Actually, Kung Fu, Pakwa, and Shen Yi was teaching. In this movie, Blood Sport, any karate guys here?
I think Sam.
Yeah, with what's Kurt Rundown?
Yeah,
Blood Sport. Yeah. It's about this international competition in Asia. About every 6 years, they have this competition, this quasi-secret thing, and you invite all the big, heavy martial art guys. It's, before, it was full contact with no pulling the punches, and deaths and maybe were frequent. So now they got to the point where they can pull the punches and stuff. It's kind of like the Olympics of martial arts. So Peter Ralston won it 1 year in the sky, so on. And he had a studio in Berkeley and stuff. So I used to walk by and look in the window. It's the same when you push the people's hands and try and get the person to move his feet and stuff. So he was facing the person. He would go all the way back like this, like that, right? You can't do that and come back up again. Literally, I'd watch this guy go, oh yeah, come back up again. He'd go with somebody, finally would let go. The person would fly 8 feet through the air. One devotee, Janardhan Das, he was a heavy brahmachari, Vajradhamadhar. He was a wrestler in college, so he went to study here. He told me one time in the beginning, Peter Ralston had six guys like him, heavy, young, healthy guys surrounded him. He said, okay, when I say go, you all jump me. So they attacked him. It was 1,001, less than 2 seconds, all six of them were on the ground and took a second to recover their breath. Six guys. So he's a magician. And so when I was finding one time I came in, I was talking to one of his students, and what's your philosophy of nature? Because it's Oriental Chinese. He said, oh, there's five elements. Water, earth, water, fire, wood, and paper. And I said, well, what about air? Oh, in Chinese martial arts philosophy, air is all pervasive, like God. So that's it. They can do it. They can prove. So that in the Western word, the actual word spirit, you breathe, you know, things like that. And that's her level of realization. They're talking about the Holy Spirit. It was moving in me. It's primal level. Okay, at least we get that maybe in the kirtan rather than grossly. Other one is sometimes the word soul is translated as the word psyche. The philosopher is the midwife of the mind, what the word for it is psyche. So psyche then is talking about the subtle body. So practically speaking, in Jewish, Christian, Judaic tradition, there's almost no word for what we're talking about. One Jewish guy said, reincarnation, vegetarian, he said, but for us, it's like a coffee cup, a styrofoam cup. You pour the coffee out and it's gone, the spirit's gone. But a little bit's always kind of a few drops hanging there. So we don't burn the body because there's some spirit is still in it. But we're like analytical knowing, can be completely separated and so on. We have a process. Yeah? So generally speaking, that's what prana and spirit, different levels of development. He was coming up to the level, as far as I can tell, of directly of space and the sun, and his experiences of the psychological elements was from here, not from here, and so on. And sometimes, he's having out of body experiences. And then trying to put it all in a catalog. And then, naturally, when he was dying, he said, oh, this is Jungian, Jung knows it all, this is the philosophy. He hated that. He said, I know only 10% I figured out what's going on. If we can take anything from you, it's courage and honesty. There's some tools, But then that's why Wolfgang Pauli gave up on Jungian tradition, because he was just making everything. Seven cities plied for the body of Homer dead, through which the living Homer begged his bread.
Yeah.
When he was alive, and then the guy, when he's dead, okay, now we can make a tomb out of him. So that was the whole thing. It's Jungian. Many Jungian psychologists who find out have fallen into this thing of Jung knows it all, nothing else is needed to be done. But Jung himself said this is all so much provisional. You asked him, if Jung was here now, he'd smoke a pipe and stop and think and say, no. Yeah, he himself would have understood tobacco is not good and everything else. Yeah. So you're dealing with it. And there are branches of healthy people that are making progress and stuff. Yeah. And if you can, again, if you can get them, in the four Kumaras, they became Paramahamsas immediately. All took one sniff. So in that sense, if you get people like that, they can become great devotees right away.
So what is holding them back now if they've made already so much progress in their previous, in their journey so far?
Yeah.
If they've made so much progress, what is holding them back now in their present life?
The same thing is holding us back in our lower thing, all the way. It's a false ego, it's free will. We have free will, choice. So at any level, we have to make these choices of. And you can imagine walking around like this, knowing people, whenever you meet everybody, you start talking, and then you can just penetrate right into this guy's mind and find out things, and have a very powerful influence on people. I mean, people are heavy. Some of them are demons. And you're going to get your Krishna consciousness challenged in a very heavy way. Why do you think that? Maybe it's, are you showing me up? You start to see, So Ravana, big guy, right? Yeah. Same thing. Free will is there at every level. The Bhagavatam is talking about these things. The Bhagavatam relates to people at all the different levels and so on. And there are fall downs at every level. Okay.
Can you say another thing that might be
helpful? What is your name?
Say it again.
Huh?
What did you say?
Your name?
Oh, my name is Max.
Max, okay.
And my name. Okay. When you say another thing that might be holding us back is the understanding of the shadow self as well? Or is that just something that.
See, the whole point of being the terminology that Jung was talking about into the West and stuff. And some of us is very directly, but other stuff, the shadow. And also, Jung was changing his ideas as he was going on. The shadow self, in some ways, would be the ahankar that we're talking about and so on. So, that's it. In some ways, that we enjoy, the manipulating the shadow self without having to. Come to our four responsibilities. And that's what you're saying. It's the same thing. Freud was just kind of analyzing everything else, didn't look at the patient. He said, no, you look at the patient. You have a moral responsibility. And these kind of things. but Freudian psychology eliminates all moral responsibility. One guy came to Jung, this and that, he analyzed this whole thing, but Jung said, the reason you're having this problem is because you look like a pig. This poor old lady who's a 35-year-old spinster, she's, you know, falling in love with you, she's giving you all your money so you can live on the Riviera while she's working like a slave for you. Until you actually go ahead and take care of that, you're going to have the same psychosis and this problem and stuff. And it's a moral problem. Yeah, yeah. So the same way is that the shadow self again, you know, is this, you know, I want to enjoy the shadow. Yeah. In the shadow, there's no real clarity about these things. Yeah. And some psychologist comes along and little things behind the shadow is a real self. Yeah. And then you've got one of the biggest Vitaranga by Akroda, fear. Fear is when you start to realize I have these responsibilities. Ultimately, I have free will, the same as God. I'm small, but He's given me. And you're not going to mess around with my life. It's frightening. I'm responsible for my life. Oh, I get it. But then you can do things that even God is in this. It's like surprise and news. It's like really not just like pretending. It's like little kid. That's free will. You can do things that even the parents and adults are just like, you know, touched. You know.
When were you at Berkeley?
I graduated was 1970.
So you were there during the free speech movement?
Oh, the whole thing, yeah. So it was a big, you know, Marshall McLuhan said war is education. And so it was just a whole, mm-hmm. I mean, the Vietnam War proved that the entire American military industrial complex could be dissolved piece by piece with nothing bigger than a 4-inch mortar.
Yeah.
And so that was like their war. And also they discovered actually that they analyzed, you know, the Art of War?
Yeah.
This book, yeah. They analyzed all the Vietnam things. So many of the fundamental principles were
Sun Tzu.
Being applied. And then they signed the peace treaty or whatever it was, the Americans. American guy was saying, we never defeated this on any battlefield. And Vietnamese general laughed and said, you never knew where the battle was. And they never said, well, if we could get it, we undermine their resources and everything else. You know, it was the people. So somebody was a big encounter with political science, and all this stuff, and then of course all these yogis were coming and everything else, you know. Mm-hmm. And I would say about 70% of the hippie revolution was based upon Hume's ideas with, you know, was Abby Hoffman, and all these people were referring to Hume and everything else. So Prabhupada, when he came, that's created the ambience, you know, where these ideas could be appreciated and so on. It was a big, Prabhupada came at that time, it was a big opportunity. And after that, it kind of closed down again. People tried to. I have a suspicion you see the number of people in the Ariskan temples was decreasing before Prabhupada left. It already had peaked and gone down. It wasn't because Prabhupada left, everything fell apart. It was already because it was this ambient. People were all talking, I'm going to work, back to work. You know, this matter is real. This quadratic thinking is where you think. You know, that. Yeah. So it's very. It happens. By karma, I suppose. Shouldn't time and mortal goodness become prominent? People can. So we look for that. You know, this life. Catch the wave. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Bye. 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 All success with your preaching.